Amanda, remember that time it was our first holiday special?
Hello, and welcome to Remember That Time, an historical podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Webb.
And I'm your host, Anna Webb, and this is a podcast where two sisters geek out about all of their favorite moments in history. And today, we're going to do a holiday special.
Yay, I'm so excited.
Yeah.
This will be fun.
I'm like ready. I'm recording by my Christmas tree today.
I'm recording by my little tree in my room.
Cute. I've got a little tree to one side of me and the big tree to the other side of me. Oh, you know, I got two trees.
So Christmas.
And I've got my Baileys on the rocks, my almond milk Baileys, because I drink responsibly in more ways than one. I am of age and drink a moderate amount, and also go dairy free because I can't do dairy.
I'm drinking water because my throat gets dry when we talk for a long time.
Also, I bought these cookies the other day while we're still talking about the holidays. I bought these cookies at Trader Joe's, and they're these like German gingerbread cookies with nuts in them. And I wish I could pronounce the name right. It's like Lebkuchen or something like that. Is there a German person that listens to our podcast that can tell me how to pronounce it? Because I'm a German person who doesn't speak German, and I really want to know how to say it right. But they are so good, and the pack is so small. I'm going to have to go back and get more like tomorrow. Because I've been eating them, like, for breakfast with my coffee.
Well, Mom and Dad got so many little Trader Joe's snick snacks that I've just been
eating. They went with me.
I know. I've been eating all of them since I got home.
So, speaking of holiday, like, treats and things, we thought we'd just go into some different holiday traditions and the histories behind them. It's going to be, full disclosure, guys, it's going to be mostly Christmas stuff. This episode, you're listening to it, if you're listening to it the day it came out, on Christmas Eve. We celebrate Christmas. We love Christmas. We're obsessed. If you don't celebrate Christmas, that's great. We're still happy you're here. Hopefully it'll still be interesting to you.
Yeah, and hopefully like next year or something we can do a different wintertime holiday for an episode like this, because we find all of that stuff really interesting. We just are pretty aggressively Christmas people.
And we came up with this idea and got very excited about it, so we just ran with it.
That's true. Yeah, so we're doing it a little differently. We're not going to just have one person present. We're going to take turns talking about Christmas stuff.
Yeah. Sorry, I was taking a drink of my Baileys.
It's going to be a running theme throughout the episode.
I'm having like an experience with the almond milk one, which I've never had before, so I'm like having a moment. I'm drinking it out of my little butterbeer thing from Harry Potter.
Ooh, nice.
Harry Potter part. So I'm going to kick things off with our first topic, and I did a little looking into Christmas carols.
Oh boy.
Anybody who knows me knows that I love Christmas carols. I love Christmas music. I start listening to Christmas music like the day after Halloween, like November 1st, it's time. Sometimes I'll listen to them. Sometimes I'll do like a Christmas in July for myself, and I'll just listen to Christmas music. So we're going to talk about Christmas music. Carols specifically, not like pop music, because obviously one came from the other. So it's not totally clear if the word carol derives from French, the word carol in French, or a Latin word that I'm not going to try to pronounce because I'll say it wrong, which means circular dance. But in any case, the dancing aspect of it seems to have been abandoned pretty early, and people just stuck with the songs.
which is probably for the best, I think.
Yeah, it's mostly a pagan tradition. Like, okay, I can't get over people being like, keep Christ in Christmas, when it's like all of our traditions are pagan. I don't want to keep Christ in Christmas for myself and celebrate the birth of our dear baby Jesus,
Lord and Savior. Baby Jesus.
But, you know, most of the traditions are pagan, so don't get too hyped up about that. But it's typically a waltz, so most of the, like, traditional carols that we still sing are usually that 3-4 time, which is
right.
A waltz.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's cool.
There's a lot of interesting factoids in here. So the first known Christian hymns, which are usually what, like, Christmas carols come from, were around the 4th century in Rome. Latin hymns with more Latin names that I'm not going to pronounce. the Latin name I can't say, but Of the Father's Heart Begotten is the English name, and it's by Spanish poet Prudentius. And that one is still sung in some churches. So, like, the ones that we still sing are, they date back all the way to the 4th century in Rome.
Wow.
Yeah. So, in the 9th and 10th centuries, the Christmas sequence, or prose, is introduced in Northern European monasteries. So, these are the sequence of rhymed stanzas that kind of turn into that lyrical thing that we are used to now, rhyming phrases and verses.
Huh.
Yeah, right? I was reading through
this. We're getting like a full song history in this one.
I was reading through this and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I kept like putting notes in. In the 12th century, Parisian monk Adam of St. Victor begins to derive music from popular songs. So these are more like the traditional carols that we have now.
Oh, okay.
But generally speaking, the person who's recognized as like creating Christmas carols or being like the father of Christmas carols is St. Francis of Assisi.
Yeah, my boy. I love St. Francis.
You know my boy.
I didn't know that he popularized carols. Yes. I love him.
Well, I'm going to tell you how he did. So he's an Italian Catholic friar, a deacon, and a preacher, obviously. Now he's the patron saint of Italy. But in the 13th century, he arranges for the first live nativity scene at Christmas. And they sing Christmas carols.
That's awesome.
And that's what makes them popular in like that part of Europe. So France, Germany, Italy.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And that's kind of why we still do the nativity and we sing carols and stuff like that still.
Huh.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
That's so cool.
I had no clue. First Christmas carols in English. So the first appearance of them is in 1426. John Audley, I probably said that wrong, who's a priest and a poet, starts popularizing them in English. He lists 25 carols, probably sung by a group of wassailers who went from house to house. So let's talk about wassailing. Yes, here we go a wassailing, typically among the leaves, so green. So there are basically two different kinds of wassailing, right? The one where you visit houses, you go house to house, and you like, give me some of your wassail, which is a beverage, by the way.
Isn't that wild that people would just go up to other people's houses and just be
give
like,
give me things. Yeah.
Hey, give me that.
Yeah. So, but the whole practice is they go door to door, they sing, and someone offers them a drink. Right. And then sometimes they bring gifts instead of singing.
Yeah. I get that it's understood that this is what we do. I just think that's such a wild thing to have ever started.
Well, there's
doing
an exchange of like a hospitality thing.
Yeah.
But it is weird. but the other kind is orchard visiting wassailing.
Huh?
Ancient custom of visiting orchards in cider-producing regions of England, where they recited incantations and sang to the trees to promote a good harvest.
That's so cool!
So,
I
more
love that.
Pagan stuff, y'all!
Let's go sing to the trees.
and bring about the cider. I do love cider. I got cider and wassail in my fridge right now.
Nice.
Because you know who sells both?
Trader Joe's.
This episode
is
not
sponsored by Trader Joe's.
Should be, though. Hey, yo, Trader Joe's, you want to hit us up? Because I love your stuff. Joe? Is it Joe?
Trader Joe?
I really enjoy your trades and goods. Would like to promote them on my podcast. I need to take another drink of my Bailey's. Pause.
I'm going to include every single one of them.
I'm excited. So the songs we know specifically as carols were originally communal songs sung during celebrations like the harvest.
Right.
Or around Christmas time and different, you know, celebrations like that. Later, it's only after all of that kind of tradition that they start being sung in churches and then were specifically associated with Christmas.
Right.
There's a typo in my notes and I have to fix it.
But that idea of stuff existing for a really long time and then being put in churches is very common for most things, but also specifically for Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, same old, am I right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we do Christmas trees because that was a pagan tradition, is trees.
I know, I'm going to talk about that
later.
Yeah,
I'm excited. Okay, here's a Latin name that I'm going to try to pronounce.
I believe in you.
Oh my God, I'm going to say it wrong. Pae Cantiones?
That sounds great.
Great, thanks. I did sing in the choir and sang lots of Latin songs. Don't know what any of it means, but I sang a lot of it. So these are, this is where like today's popular carols were originally printed. It's a collection of late medieval Latin songs, and it was printed around 1582.
Wow.
Yeah. So this had Latin versions of like, Christ was born on Christmas Day, good Christian men rejoice, and everybody's favorite, and my favorite, Good King Wenceslas.
Classic.
I love that song. I love that song. O Come All Ye Faithful, which has a different Latin name, appears in its current form in the mid-18th century, but the words probably originated around the 13th century.
Cool. I'm going to say cool so many times in this episode.
I know, me too. I'm going to be like, that's so cool.
I've made my peace with it.
Cool. Word of the day is cool. Have a cool Christmas or whatever you celebrate. So these songs gained more popularity after the Reformation in countries where Protestant churches gained more prominence. Here comes our man, Martin Luther, offering lots of carols and encouraging.
We'll see him again later for sure.
He starts to encourage their use like in worship services.
Right.
Because that was Martin Luther's gig.
That was his whole jam.
He was like, the Catholics say not to. Oh, we're definitely going to do it. In the 19th century, this is when we start getting like publications of Christmas music books that are like distributed. So that like widens the span of people using them. Christmas Carols and Ancient and Modern is published in 1833 by William Sandys. It's the first appearance in print of God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, The First Noel, I Saw Three Ships, and Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
Yes.
Some of my faves. Ones. Some of my faves. In 1871, we get the publication of Christmas Carols New and Old by Henry Ramsden. Henry Ramsden Bramley and Sir John Saint Stainer. And this kind of is, so this is around the Victorian time. So this is, this kind of revives carols in Victorian England.
I was about to ask if they were English because those are super very English names.
Yeah. And that's a super English name for a book. Christmas Carols New and Old.
New and Old.
Christmas Carols New and Old.
Oh, no.
That's a really bad Cockney accent. Sorry, y'all. So in the 20th century, the Oxford University Press publishes Carols for Choirs. This is one of the most popular carol books in the English-speaking world, like, still. It was first published in 1961 and now has expanded to a 5-volume set.
Wow.
Okay, so here's a fun carol fact. And I'm just going to read this quote because I think it's really great. A modern form of the practice of caroling can be seen in Dial a Carol, an annual tradition held by students at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, I don't know, wherein potential audiences call the singers to request a performance over phone call. And I find it great that it says a performance, because they're not calling in and being like, yo, DJ, play The First Noel. They're like, will you perform The First
Sing
Noel?
Sing it for me right now on the phone.
Oh, I want to do it so bad. We have to find That's the information excellent. For this.
Absolutely.
Because I need to do that. So carols traditionally are based on like medieval chord patterns.
Yeah.
So this is how we can trace a bunch back to the Middle Ages, like Good King Wenceslas and The Holly and the Ivy. That kind of.
Oh, I love that one.
You know what I'm talking about. Isaac Watts, who was considered the father of English hymns, father of English hymns, composed Joy to the World, which is obviously still very popular. It's widely believed that he actually did not write that to be sung only at Christmas.
Well,
which I guess makes sense.
It's more general than that.
I guess. I mean, it is talking about the birth of Christ.
Yeah, and I also think that's just the time of year that we tend to sing songs like that.
Yeah, but I guess it could be an Easter song.
Yeah.
If you interpreted it differently. I don't know.
Probably.
And then here we go. Amanda, are you ready for this one? Here's our dude, Charles Wesley.
Yes. Ooh. Oh, my God. I love Charles Wesley so
Amanda
much.
Amanda and I are Methodists. Charles Wesley's brother founded our denomination.
I have a statue of his brother on my campus.
Yeah, it was my campus too. Like, we are down with the Wesley brothers. He wrote texts for at least 3 Christmas carols, but he wrote over around 6,500 hymns.
He sure did. And his rules for singing are the greatest thing in the world.
Oh my God. Okay, if you ever find yourself in a Methodist church or anywhere near a Methodist hymnal, please turn to, it's one of the first pages in the book, and it's his rules for singing. They are amazing and ridiculous, and I love them. My favorite one, and I don't know which rule it is, but it's where he says, if you have learned these songs any differently, unlearn them immediately and relearn them this way, basically. Because he adapted a lot of old, like, pub songs to become hymns. So a lot of the original lyrics were, like, not appropriate for church. So he wrote down as a rule, like, unlearn that and learn this instead. And I'm obsessed with it.
So. Hey, are you a booze hound? Don't sing that song in church.
Amazing. But he wrote Hark the Herald Angels Sing, which was originally called Hark How All the Welkin Rings. Uh-oh. Which I bet we could find the original lyrics for somewhere.
Probably.
Here's a fun one. Silent Night.
Ooh,
Silent
yeah.
Night was from Austria. The carol was first performed in the Church of St. Nicholas in, I'm going to pronounce something else wrong, Oberndorf, Austria. On Christmas Eve, 1818, Joseph Mohr was the writer of the words. And in 1816, he took them to Franz Gruber. Oh, I'm sorry. No, he wrote the lyrics in 1816, and he took them to Franz Gruber in 1818 to compose the melody for a Christmas Eve service. And guess who's related to Franz Gruber? Ya girls.
It's us. We're related to Franz Gruber. My choir teacher made me tell this story every Christmas and then made us all sing Silent Night in German every Christmas.
That's so great. Our great aunt used to talk about it all the time. She'd be like, you know you're related to him. We'd be like, yeah, we know. We're related to him on our mom's side.
There's also a part of that story that's like their organ was broken, and so he had to play it on guitar, even though he composed it for the piano, which I think was really cool. Yeah.
And the first English translation was in 1871. And guess where it was published for the first time in English? In a Methodist hymnal.
That's wild! That's so great!
Oh, man. So that's our history of for
the
Christmas
only
Carol.
Famous person at all that we're
that we know
to.
Of. Singing carols in church was instituted on Christmas Eve, 1880, in Truro Cathedral, Cornwall. Songs chosen omitted the Wassailing carols. They were like, nah.
Rude!
And most churches have special services for singing carols, generally combined with readings of scripture about the birth of our Lord and Savior, baby Jesus Christ. and that's usually based on the Festival of Nine Lessons in Carols, which was from King's College in Cambridge, which we've done.
We do a Lessons in Carols at Wesleyan.
Yeah, they do Lessons in Carols every year. Our friend Brooke, who also went to Wesleyan, would come back for it like all the time when the choir director that she sang for was still there.
Sis, when I came to visit you the other weekend, I came back as Lessons in Carols was finishing. And so there was just a horde of people out around the tree that we put the lights on. And I was like, I'm definitely going to hit somebody.
Yeah, for sure. I've done that. I've come onto campus like as they were all coming out to light the tree before. And I was like, oh, God. Have you ever been to the service at Wesleyan?
Yeah.
It sounds amazing in that chapel.
Oh, it's the best.
So good. Well, that's what I had on Christmas carols. So.
Oh, boy. That was great.
Thanks.
I got very excited. When I knew you were going to do carols, I was like, is she going to talk about
it? Of course. I can't omit our own history when we're talking about history.
I know.
I'm excited for your stuff because I have not read any of your notes.
Because I like only very recently wrote them because I've been having finals.
I wouldn't have had time anyway because I've been crazy busy, but I'm very excited to hear what you.
Yeah. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is Christmas decorations.
I love Christmas decorations.
I know. I put in a few that were like popular that had sort of interesting little histories or like original versions or whatever. So I wanted to start out by talking about Christmas trees.
Christmas tree, Christmas tree. I was singing the song Linda Does on Bob's Burgers.
Oh.
Oh, no. It might be from The Office.
Which one was it?
Christmas tree, how I love the Christmas tree.
I don't think that's
I think
Linda.
It's Andy. Anyway.
Anyway, there's a really, really long history of using trees around this time of year. So ancient Egyptians celebrated the winter solstice to celebrate the return of the sun after months of darkness.
I feel that.
Yep. They would fill their homes with evergreens as a reminder that green plants will return with the sun's return.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah.
I like that.
Early Romans celebrated Saturnalia around the solstice in honor of the god of agriculture.
You pronounced Saturnalia so perfectly.
Thank you.
And then you couldn't get agriculture.
No, my mouth couldn't make it happen.
So good. You said it and I was like, oh, she does such a good job. Better than anything I pronounced.
Immediately couldn't say agriculture. The end of winter meant that farmers would be able to farm again, so they would decorate with evergreens to celebrate. Sure. So it's a very similar theme.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Celtic druids used evergreens to symbolize life over death.
Oh, I want to know a lot more about Celtic druids. Well, you have to do an episode on Celtic druids someday.
I would 100% do that. I love that. I could do a whole thing on Arthurian legend and old Celtic druids.
I know, you're super into it.
My favorite. Anyway. So... in the 16th century in Germany, German Christians started decorating trees at Christmas time. So that's the first time we see those older traditions of other faiths and other cultures who used evergreens forever start being brought to Europe. Christians.
Can I take a moment here while we're talking about Germany to bust out my Heidi Klum impersonation?
Oh, now is the perfect time.
Okay, great. I was trying to think of the perfect sentence to say. I'm Heidi Klum, and this is my Christmas tree in Germany. One day you're in, and the next day you're out.
It's very good. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you. Thank you for thank you for giving me the floor for my moment.
Of course, of course. The amount of times that we're probably going to talk about Germany in this episode.
I know, I felt like I needed to get it in once.
Yeah, it was bound to happen eventually. So eventually, the tradition of bringing trees in at Christmas time comes to America. People originally don't like it because of its pagan roots, mm-hmm. but it gets popularized. Oh my gosh.
Take three.
Popularized. I can't today, I guess. In Britain in 1846 by Queen Victoria when she's pictured with a tree behind her.
I watched that episode of Victoria.
Oh.
With Jenna Coleman. It was great.
But she was very popular, and so people were like, oh, she has a tree.
And she took
we can do a tree.
She took the picture with, like, her whole family.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just like, ah, the queen has put a tree in her house. It was like the whole family got together, and it became, like, a family tradition because she popularized it.
Yep. And that's also why it got popular in America, is because of that. Like,
she was such a trendsetter.
Yeah, people originally were like, no, we don't want to do that. And then they saw the English queen do it, and they were like, oh, we can get down with that, I guess.
I think Queen Victoria was the original trendsetter.
Probably. So one of my favorite Christmas tree decorations are baubles.
Mm-hmm.
So baubles, I don't know, everybody says it differently. The baubles. Little glass balls that you put on the Christmas tree.
Yeah, that's it. I'm looking at two right now.
A German artist named Hans Greiner?
Sure. We're doing a lot of that.
Yep, it's the day of it, I guess. He starts producing blown glasses shaped like fruits and nuts in the 1840s that people would hang on their Christmas trees.
Interesting.
And Woolworth Department Store sells them in America starting in 1890, and it got very popular, mm-hmm. and they made a lot of money off of it. And then eventually, over time, it stopped being fruit and nut shaped and just turned into a glass ball.
I'm surprised I don't have any Fenton art glass baubles on my tree.
Oh, yeah.
We have some on Mom and Dad's tree. If you don't know what we're talking about, Amanda and I are from a small town in West Virginia, and there's a glass factory there. Well, it's not there anymore, but there was a glass factory there. It was the only one in the world called Fenton Art Glass, and the Fentons, like, own the whole town. And they make all this glass stuff, and, like, our houses are just full of it because everybody in the town has Fenton art glass everywhere.
Yep.
And I know that Mom has some. She's got like an angel or something. But I don't have any for my tree. And now I can't get one because they're out of business.
Sad.
Bummer. I bet we could find one though.
Probably.
Grandma probably has 100.
Probably. So another tree ornament is tinsel,
mm-hmm.
which is also German in origin. Who's surprised?
Mm-hmm.
It used to be shredded pieces of silver.
Yeah.
they would like
I knew
hammer
that
it out and flatten it until it was really, really, really thin.
It would cut you.
And then they would shred it and put it on their trees.
Yes, it would cut you when you'd pick it up. Yeah. I remember, I knew that. Grandma Webb, so our dad's mom, used to have the one, you know, it wasn't real silver. Obviously, it was like the tinsely stuff we know now. But she, we used to put that on her tree. And she would tell me about how, like, at least you don't cut yourself on it now.
Yeah. Well, and they used to put candles on trees instead of lights.
I find that ridiculous.
I'll talk about that in a second. But the smoke from the candles turned the tinsel black.
Well, sure.
Yeah. So partially that and partially the need to not have little pieces of silver all over your house.
Oh, man.
Eventually, people started using plastic to make it. Right. And that's what it is today. So people put lights on trees because they were supposed to represent stars. Christmas stars.
Twinkle lights, like stars.
Yeah. They used to be candles.
Good word association, Anna. God.
They used to be candles, which was so dangerous because they were
outrageous.
Live trees in people's homes. Ugh. And I read somewhere that like insurance companies at some point were like, no, we have to put electric lights on it because it's too dangerous to keep putting candles on the trees.
Absurd.
Yeah, that's wild. And then I took some notes on a couple of other evergreen plants that we see around this time of year.
Yes.
So mistletoe is a big one.
Mm-hmm. I love this one. I'm very interested in mistletoe.
Oh, yeah. So it is an evergreen plant that has a lot of poisonous varieties, actually. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The kind that we hang isn't, but the plant itself comes with some poison. Mm-hmm.
Don't ingest your mistletoe. It probably won't hurt, but don't ingest it.
Nah. Druids believed that it could ward off evil spirits and bring good luck.
Yes, great.
So that was part of the reason that it's hung.
Right. In doorways.
Yeah. So here's the history of kissing under the mistletoe, which I think is really interesting. In Norse mythology, I'm just going to read this straight up from something I found.
Okay.
One of the powerful Norse god Odin's sons, named Balder, was said to be invincible due to an oath his mother took to protect him from harm. But Loki, a god who often set out to make trouble for the gods, set out to find the one thing that could do some damage and eventually discovered that Balder's mother, Frigg, had never included mistletoe in her invincibility oath.
Oh, such an oversight.
Yeah. When mistletoe was finally responsible for her son's demise, the grieving Frigg vowed that the plant would never again be used to hurt another living thing, and that she would plant a peaceful kiss upon anyone who walked underneath it.
I love that!
Isn't that incredible?
Oh my god, the leaving out the mistletoe is like the Achilles heel.
Yeah. And then,
oh, that's great.
I just think that's so,
I love mythology.
And I love that she didn't, vow to destroy the plant. She vowed to make it peaceful. Yes. I just think that's so cool.
It's like the opposite of what would have happened in Greek mythology.
Yeah, exactly. But there was also a tradition of using mistletoe in Saturnalia celebrations because it was a celebration of abundance and fertility. So kissing was a symbol of fertility. So they would kiss under the mistletoe.
Sure.
To, bless people.
I like the other one better.
I do, too. But most of these things have, 1,000 sources, and that's why we still do it today, because it, all came together. So holly is another evergreen that we see this time of year.
Love it.
And the sharp leaves represent the crown of thorns that Jesus wore, and the red berries represent the blood of Jesus.
Sounds like we're using it for the wrong holiday.
Yeah, I know. And then we also see poinsettias a lot.
Love.
Which is great.
I'm allergic to the real ones, though, but... they're pretty.
But they're so pretty. They are native to southern Mexico.
Ooh.
And they flower during the winter.
Right.
And that's why we see them. Some people say it's shaped like the Star of Bethlehem. So that's one of the reasons that we put it out during Christmas.
I can see that.
And then I love this little story. A Mexican legend tells of a girl who could only offer weeds as a gift to Jesus on Christmas Eve. When she brought the weeds into a church, they blossomed into the beautiful red plants we know as poinsettias.
I love that.
Which is the Spanish word for flowers of the holy night.
Ugh.
Is what they're known as.
I love that.
I do too. That's I think great. That one's really cool.
I like poinsettias.
The story is that she went out and picked a weed, but the weed was the like leaves of the poinsettia plant. When she brought him in, it flowered, and I just think that was really sweet.
Whenever they have them like in church, you know, like you can buy poinsettias and they'll put them out in church like for the Christmas service. And if they're real, I just spend the whole time being like, it's like really gross. So should we talk about Christmas food?
Yes, please. Oh, excellent. My gosh.
I've got lots of different like kind of holiday foods here.
And oh my gosh, I'm going to get so hungry by the end of this portion of this. I'm not ready.
We'll talk about each one. So Christmas dinner. Why do we have Christmas dinner? Well, it's like a rich and substantial meal. And it's in the tradition of Christian feast day celebrations. So this comes from the calendar of saints, which was like a traditional Christian way of organizing the liturgical year by associating each day with saints. So the day is referred to as the feast day of like X saint, whichever saint.
Right.
So feast in that context meant a religious tradition, like an annual tradition, like in a day dedicated to it. But it kind of grew into like an actual feast of food for Christmas or certain holidays. So that's where that like term comes from and why we like it becomes a tradition, and especially in a lot of European countries, to like have a Christmas dinner. Huh. You know?
Yeah, that's cool.
So gingerbread.
Ooh, yes.
Popular Christmas cookie. The first known recipe was said to be from Greece in about 2400 BCE.
Oh my gosh.
And it made its way to England, where Elizabeth I was credited with the idea of decorating it.
That's cool.
And probably turning it into a person, but I don't know for sure.
I cannot believe how old the first known recipe for gingerbread
is. I assume it was probably vastly different, but it kind of grew into what it is. But I don't know. I don't know. That's just what I read.
Pretty wild.
Yeah. And I've been eating these German gingerbread cookies like they were cookies. I don't know. I'm very tired. I'm not like a massive gingerbread fan.
I love
the flavor. I think that the way that we eat gingerbread cookies, like if they're too hard, I don't like them.
I was gonna say, I honestly prefer just straight up eating
like soft gingerbread
cookies.
Yeah I like gingerbread flavored things too.
Oh yeah,
gingerbread coffee, yes please. Cranberry sauce. So this was created by Marcus L. Uran. I don't know if the U is pronounced like that. He was a lawyer who left his career to buy a cranberry bog in Hanson, Massachusetts. And he was the first person to sell canned cranberries in 1912.
This sounds like the plot of a Hallmark movie.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. But it was to extend the short selling season because they're so seasonal and they don't grow for that long. So he started canning them to sell them. Huh. And then they would use the canned cranberries to make the sauce. So basically,
that's cool.
You basically just like cook it down with sugar, right? So it becomes a sauce.
Somebody should make a historic Hallmark movie about this man.
I totally agree. Oh my God. There would be a woman who would come to the cranberry bog and she'd be like, her name would be like Holly. And she'd be like, she would just have lost the spirit of Christmas. And they'll meet and fall in love, and she'll remember what Christmas is all about when they give canned cranberries to all of the homeless children in their neighborhood.
Oh, yes. That's a Christmas to me.
That is a Christmas to me. I should send that to Justin McElroy.
You absolutely should.
Fruitcake.
Ooh, so a rough one.
Fruitcake was likely created during the Middle Ages when dried fruits and nuts were super expensive. Mm. So the holiday season made it like a special occasion to buy the ingredients and prepare them into a cake.
Huh.
That's all I really
do. Do you have any idea why it's so despised now?
Because it doesn't taste very good.
Yeah.
Have you ever had fruitcake?
I don't think I
have. It has the ability, like it has the potential to be a really delicious treat, but it is just not. I don't know what it is. I feel like maybe it's the combination of different dried fruits. Because, like, think about it. A cranberry cake, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever other kind of fruits they put
apple cake, yes.
But then they put different kinds, and then with nuts, and it just isn't – it's not great. I'm sure there's someone out there who makes a good fruit cake. But it's just not the best – not the best tasting thing. So that's all I had about fruit cake. I didn't go too in depth about it. But let's talk about candy cake.
Ooh, yes.
I love candy canes. They're some of my favorite treats. I eat them all the time. I love them. I love them. I love them.
Do you want to hear something ridiculous?
Yes.
My D&D group, we did a Christmas special wherein our DM made us fight Santa. And his weapons were like hook blades that looked like candy canes.
That's excellent.
And he named them Holly and Jolly, and I've never been more angry in my life.
That's great. Oh, man. Well, candy canes were originally all white and completely straight, so they're basically just sugar sticks.
That's no fun.
The earliest reference is a record from the 1837 exhibition of the Massachusetts Charitable Mechanic Association, where, okay, like, confections and treats were judged competitively, so it was like a competition.
Huh.
The recipe for the candy sticks was published in 1844. Candy canes start being seen, like, references to them in, like, literature in around 1866, but there's no description of their color or flavor. In 1670, so here's where we're going to get into why people know what candy canes are and why people are so into them at Christmas time. So in 1670, a choir master at Cologne, Germany Cathedral bent the sticks to represent the shepherd's staff and gave them to children, like, in a nativity scene, basically trying to quiet them down during the Christmas Eve service.
That's adorable.
And he used the white color to teach them about the sinless life of Jesus.
That's precious.
Yeah, but that's, you know, because that's what we tell kids now. We're like, well, it's like the shepherd's crook. Like, cause,
yeah.
But that's what he bent them to look like that, to quiet them down.
But still make it about the Lord.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, shut up. Here's something about Jesus.
In terms of the manufacturing, so Chicago confectioners, the Bundt brothers, B-U-N-T-E, I don't know exactly how to say it, Bundt brothers, they filed for one of the earliest patents for candy cane making machines around the early 1920s. So it's a machine that basically will create the sticks for them and like twist them and bend them. In 1919... in Albany, Georgia, Robert McCormick began making them for local children. And in the mid-20th century, his company became like the leading candy cane producers. They were called the Famous Candy Company. Or, I'm sorry, that's what I think that might be what they're called now. Back then, they were the Mills McCormick Candy Company. And at one point, they were Bob's Candies. I don't know why we got there. I mean, I guess his name is Robert, but...
Yeah.
McCormick's brother-in-law, Gregory Harding Keller, patented the Keller machine, which automated the process of twisting the candy canes into a spiral and striping them and then cutting them at the precise lengths. And that was in 1957. So that's basically the machine that is still used to make candy canes.
I wonder why the red came in, because they were white for so long.
I don't know. I couldn't really find much information on it. I think it was about like when they made their way to America and dyeing candies and foods became pretty popular.
And that makes
sense. Using dyes in candy was like easy.
Right.
And I think they just started doing it because they could.
Oh, sis, the other day I had a candy cane and I was drinking an Oreo milkshake from Cat's Paw and I put it in there and it was really good.
That sounds delicious.
I made a good decision that
day. I've been snacking on candy canes every day for like weeks. So let's talk eggnog.
Oh, this is an interesting one.
So eggnog is based on a medieval drink called posset. It was milk, eggs, and some form of alcohol. Usually...
That...
I know, it sounds disgusting.
Just in theory sounds so disgusting.
Usually the alcohol was sherry or like Madeira. And the ingredients were expensive when it first became a thing. So it was like for wealthy people.
Hey, wealthy people, do you want to drink something disgusting?
Yes.
Put the most expensive things into one drink and
wealthy
drink
people
it.
Always wanted to drink something disgusting if it meant that it could show off how wealthy they are.
That's fair.
And it was also sometimes used as cold or flu remedies. Eventually, American colonists were able to harvest the ingredients on their own. And that kind of helped the drink become popular because they could make it themselves. And rum was used as a substitute for like the wine or brandy or whatever, because it was less expensive. And those drinks that were like traditionally used in it were more heavily taxed. And rum was easier to get their hands on.
Huh. That just, why did somebody make that?
I don't
know. It sounds so disgusting. I can't.
Yeah. And then my last Christmas food, figgy pudding.
Oh, bring us some.
Bring us some. And bring it right here. It dates back to the 16th century in, guess what, England.
Surprise.
I don't know if there's like a standard like first recipe because the methods and ingredients tend to differ. One thing that I found that I just thought was funny, it just included in here, like a place where you could have found the recipe was Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management from 1861. It was a guide to maintaining a household in Victorian Britain. And apparently one of the critical pieces of that was creating figgy pudding.
Do you want to manage a household? Make some figgy pudding.
Yeah.
It's the only way.
The term figgy pudding comes from the song We Wish You a Merry Christmas.
Really?
Yes. Some 19th century sources say that in the West Country of England, figgy pudding originally referred to a raisin or plum pudding, so it didn't even have figs in it. But now it's more of a cake made with figs and topped with brandy. It was banned by English Puritans in the 1600s because of how much alcohol was in it.
Sure. Sounds about right.
Yeah. But they like light it on fire and burn off the alcohol. You know, you've seen Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
You know, you get it.
I can't believe that the term came from the song.
Well, I mean, you know, when you're making it, it's like, oh, it's just a pudding.
Right.
With, like, dried fruit in it or whatever.
Huh.
You wouldn't say, that is a figgy pudding.
Yeah.
It was a thing that somebody who wrote the song used to describe the pudding, and then it became the popular thing to call it.
Huh. That's cool.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to talk about the history of Santa Claus.
Papa Gigi.
Papa Gigi. So there are several sources of what is now Santa Claus, but I'm going to talk about the big two.
Okay.
Which are St. Nicholas, who was born in the 4th century in what is now Turkey, and he's the patron saint of children. One of the legends around him was that he gave dowries to 3 poor girls who were going to be slaved or prostitutes otherwise.
Okay.
Which is wild.
Wouldn't be the story of a saint if it weren't dark.
Weren't dark with a slight silver lining on it.
Yeah.
I read a version of this legend that said he dropped the bags of gold down their chimney and it landed in their stockings that were drying by the fire.
Sure.
But he was alive in like the 4th century and I don't think the chimneys were a thing yet.
I don't know, maybe.
Maybe.
It's just a ventilation for your fire.
Yeah. That's true. But I guess that's where that idea of putting presents in stockings is. But who knows?
Who knows?
His feast day is December 6th, which is the anniversary of his death. You were talking about feast days earlier. That's his.
All connected, as Tracy Faber used to say. That was our French teacher in high school.
And children were given gifts in his honor on this day because he was the saint of children.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense.
Martin Luther propagated giving gifts to children on Christmas instead of on the 6th to focus on Christ's love for children and to move away from the veneration of saints.
Of course.
So, yet
He's
again.
Like, that's a Catholic thing. Not interested. But I don't want to take things away from the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He just found ways to take all of the stuff that the Catholics did and make it still fun for Protestants.
And we still do it now.
The Dutch name for St. Nicholas is Sint Nicholas?
Nicolas.
Yeah. Which was shortened to Sinterklaas.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Which was a nickname for that, and that eventually developed into Santa Claus.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And actually, in a lot of Dutch countries, they still give gifts on the 6th, and they're from Sinterklaas and not Santa Claus.
Oh, do they also do Santa Claus? And say, like, same guy, different day.
Some other places do it on Christmas from Santa, and some places do it on both.
Got
I read
it.
That, like, a third of Dutch people do one of those three things. Like, it's split up into thirds.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. The other source of Santa Claus is Father Christmas, which is the English personification of Christmas. And it dates back to the 16th century in England, which is during Henry VIII's reign.
Hey-o!
There's our boy.
The infamous Henry VIII, who's made several appearances on the pod so far.
infamous on this podcast.
Uh-huh. Infamous everywhere. Let's not, you know, limit it.
That's true. Father Christmas is the spirit of good cheer at Christmas, and he brings peace, joy, good food, and wine and revelry, which I enjoy.
Aw, yeah.
Party hard with Father Christmas.
Party hard, Father Christmas.
He is typically pictured as a large man wearing a fur-lined red or green robe.
Of course.
And he is the inspiration for the illustration of the Ghost of Christmas Present and a Christmas
Carol.
Yes,
I love that.
That's where that comes from.
I knew that. Go me. Go Charles Dickens.
So those two figures kind of merged and their traditions and the things surrounding them became what is now Santa Claus. In 1821, a poem called Santa Claus with Much Delight described Santa on a reindeer sleigh delivering presents to children.
Ah.
So this is when we start seeing Santa in America more. And then in 1823, a poem called A Visit from St. Nicholas, which is now known as The Night Before Christmas, was anonymously published. So there's like a lot of argument about who actually wrote that one.
I had to memorize that poem in the 8th grade?
I never had to do that.
8th or 9th grade. For Ms. Goldsworthy's English class, we had to memorize the whole thing and recite it in front of the whole class. So I still know it. One of my classmates, I'll tell you who later, but you probably won't be surprised, dressed up as Santa for the recitation.
Right.
Like wore the whole costume to school. Fake Great. Beard Excellent. And all. And we still make our, I have this beautiful pop-up book of the story, which is like my favorite thing. And we found another copy for Amanda to keep because the original was mine. That we make our dads read to us every year on Christmas Eve still.
We are grown
adults. I am 26 years old and I still make him do it every year.
Yep. So this poem includes the now popular description of Santa. Sure. Jolly and
plump.
Rosy cheeks and
a right jolly old elf.
A right jolly old elf. It also named the reindeer.
Right.
So this was the first place where those names are listed. I thought this was interesting.
I'm sorry, I was reading ahead.
Yeah, the original names of the reindeer are Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid. Oh my gosh. Cupid. And then Dunder and Blixem, which came from the old Dutch words for thunder and lightning,
okay.
which were later changed to the more German-sounding names Donner and Blitzen.
They're better. No offense, Dutch people, but Dunder and Blixem are rough. Like, if you were a reindeer and you were named that, like... Who was really the outcast? I don't think it was Rudolph. It was Dunder and Blixem.
I just like that they're named after thunder and lightning.
When I say Blixem, I feel like I'm mispronouncing Blitzen.
Yep. So Thomas Nash. Oh my gosh, I cannot talk today. I'm going to try that one again. Thomas Nash.
Got it in
popular,
two.
Yeah, popular cartoonist who was one of the first people to draw Santa as he is traditionally seen today. So fat. Red suit, blah,
sure,
blah, blah.
Sure.
And he drew that in
1863.
Wow. Oh, boy.
I'm the one drinking something alcoholic, by the way.
I know. I'm drinking water. I'm so tired. He published his drawings in Harper's Weekly. And in 1866, he published a collage of engravings of Santa called Santa Claus and His Works. Hmm. And the caption said, Santa Clausville, NP. So popularizing the idea that he lives in the North Pole.
Oh
so that's
God.
Where that comes from.
I love that I can call his little like workshop and village Santa Clausville now and have a real reason to do that. I like that.
I do too. I think that's so great.
That is so great. What's your favorite like illustration of Santa? Do you have one?
Oh, geez. I don't know if I have one.
Mine is the Coca-Cola Santa.
I was about to say, I think it's the Coca-Cola Santa. I just think he's so like...
Classic.
Classic. Yeah, I love the Coca-Cola Santa.
God, I was so into Santa. We used to watch the NORAD Santa Tracker.
We sure did.
Which wasn't a thing when I was real little, but when Amanda was real little, it was a thing, and she would get extremely excited. We would, like, come home from our Christmas Eve celebration with our family, and she'd be like, turn it on! And we'd, like, watch it on the computer all night.
And I would force everyone to go to bed before he got to us.
Yes, she would make everybody go to bed, and then we weren't allowed to wake our parents up, like, crazy early. They would give us a time. They'd be like, you can't wake us up before this time. But Amanda would always wake up because she was like, you know, an awake child. And she would like come into my room and she'd be like, sis, it's Christmas. And I'd be like, great, you can lay here, just shh. And then I'd go back to sleep for a little bit. Oh, Christmas.
I also always used to try and find Santa because we had one of those Santa website things that was like, send your list to Santa, but
yes.
It emailed the list to mom and dad.
Right.
And you told Santa whether
I'm
not
sorry.
You had a chimney.
Hold on. What a great, like, plan that was.
It's
that was
so
like, put
good.
In your parents' email address. That was great.
Yeah.
Anyway. And it would ask, do you have a chimney? And Amanda would be like, no.
And so he would come in the front door. So when I would have to wake up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, I would watch the front door and see if Santa was there.
I would
there.
Listen for footsteps. I was telling someone earlier today that we used to, because they were talking about how they do Elf on the Shelf with their kids, which we never did. But I was saying, like, our dad used to, like, tell us he could see elves watching us to watch our behavior. And I used to do it to you too when you were still Santa aged, and I would like look out and I'd be like, oh my gosh, I think it's on Elf, and you'd be like, oh, where?
I remember that, because
he used to do that when we'd start acting up. He'd be like, I think I saw an elf outside, and we'd like straighten up. Not that we were badly behaved children, but we were like getting on his nerves, I guess.
He also set up the video camera the night before so it would be ready in the morning, like, to record Christmas.
Santa turned it off,
and he told us that he was recording Santa. And then he would come downstairs and be like, Santa turned it off.
He'd be like, that's so weird. It didn't – it turned off. That's so weird. And our dad still films every Christmas morning. So we put our Christmas tree downstairs, like from where we sleep. And so we all get up in the morning and we have to like wait for them to make their coffee and tea. And like, you know – and he, like, dad goes downstairs before us and, like, won't let us come until he has turned the camera on. Like, won't let us. So we, like, have to wait at the bottom of the stairs for him to turn the camera on so we can come down. Still, we have a lot of traditions.
We do.
But they're fun.
Yeah. Well, that was our holiday special.
I really enjoyed it. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And we'll try to come up with something different for next year. But, you know, we are also open to suggestions for other holidays that we can look up the history on. Yes. Like, not this time of year, just, like, throughout the year.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, if you want to tell us some of your holiday traditions, we'd love to hear them.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You can tweet them to us at rttpod. You can also email us at rememberthatpod@gmail.com. And you can find us under Remember That Podcast?
Oh.
Remember That Time Podcast? I can't remember. On Facebook. You can find us on Facebook. Just search Remember That Time and we'll come up. If you want to follow me on social media, I'm at The Real Anna Webb on every platform.
And I'm at ACW Nerdfighter all over the place.
Last podcast, I mentioned the Project for Awesome.
Yes.
I hope that some of you were able to go check that out. It just wrapped up fundraising last night, and they raised, let me double check. So through the like fundraising site that they do via Indiegogo, there were $730,000 in donations. With matching funds, the total was $1.64 million.
Yeah, so, that's awesome.
Lots of money for different charities. It was a really good time. If you didn't get to participate this year, definitely recommend it for next year. It's a good holiday tradition to have.
It is. It's great. We do it every year.
Every year.
We always watch it together, even when we're not together.
Aww, sisters.
Sisters.
Well, thank you guys for listening. I don't know what we'll be doing for the next episode.
Me either, which is a fun game where we never know what we're doing.
But it will be after the new year. So this is our last episode of the year, last episode of 2018. But we'll be back in 2019. Oh, boy, 2019, it's happening. It's coming. So I hope you all have happy holidays, whatever you celebrate. If you don't celebrate holidays, I hope you just have a happy day.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks for listening.
All right, who's doing it this time?
You do it.
Who starts?
You start.
Me start? Mm-hmm. All right, so until next time.
Remember that time.